Well, we just came off Max's excellent course on the gray ropes at the Parallax, and I would like first of all to hear Max's description of the whole experience. And what did you learn? What came out of doing the gray ropes at Parallax?
The most surprising thing was the sense of, and this is going to sound selfish and navel gazing, and I don't mean it to, but was that people would turn to me, someone who's for almost my entire life been an atheist, for spiritual guidance. That the participants in the course really felt that I had something to bring in this regard. And that surprised me, frankly. And I'm not trying to set myself up as a guru, certainly, unless it's like you say, Bard, gurus is like they meet in India, which is just a teacher. But I felt I'm be feeling in my old age more and more called to this idea of being a guide. And some of it comes with age, but and some comes a little bit of wisdom of experience, but also there is overcoming one's humility about knowing anything has to do, I think, with the era we're entering in that is so uncertain, and bringing a sense of orderliness and certainty out of the chaos, or at least chaotic order, ordered chaos is better, the better term, is something that the world needs right now. And so I felt that my part of that participation was bringing that, and I was surprised. I was also surprised by the experience that people from different countries and different walks of life could find so much commonality. Now, of course, people who are drawn to something like that self-select, and that's of course good. That's what you want in some sense with when you market something or you try to communicate what it is you're doing. But if you aren't starting from a point of significant overlaps with something as cosmopolitan effort as this is, then it'll just go in time. And what I don't think we, I certainly don't want that to happen.
This rhymes so well with me because I've been doing philosophy and I've written six books with Jan Söderqvist over the past, say, 25 years. That's the work experience we've had. And I also discovered in that process, I remember my uncle told me when I was a child that theology is deep philosophy in the sense that the question of the absolute, no matter how you apply it, like I said, if you're an atheist, your problem is you're going to have to chase gods to kill all the time because there's so many variants of them. So maybe one day you'll give up and just realize God is just a name for the absolute in any different worldview. But I had that in mind, and I was an artist. I made music before I started doing philosophy. And of course, the last three books, the Grand Erratology that we finished publishing last year, with the last three books, the theology became so obvious, and it's like I couldn't. I think a philosopher must be an activist, but I think up to that point, until I started writing these three books 10 years ago with Jan, until that point, I always assumed that a philosopher would be a political activist. Because that was like the standard 20th century version. I'm into French and German philosophy, and you'd be a Sartre, you'd be a Foucault, you'd be out the political activist, you're politically engaged with the world. And then I remember that my old friend Simon Critchley, another philosopher who I strongly recommend, Simon Critchley wrote some 15 years ago, I think, he wrote that famous one-liner where he said that this is not a time for revolution, this is a time for retraction. The revolution has become impossible. Of course, Jan's and my variation of that theme is to say that the revolution is impossible because the revolution is now a technological period. We're living in the midst of a massive technological revolution, whether we like it or not. It's just unfolding. And the only response we can have to a revolution we can no longer control is out of control, man versus machine. The machine's moving ahead, man's getting stuck. The only way to deal with that is to go into retraction mode. So when I then rethink my role as a philosopher, where I have to be an active agent in the world, otherwise I'm just crap. It's called armchair philosopher as a pejorative term for a good reason. Like, so if you're an activist, it was impossible to political activist. I had to become a spiritual activist. And for me, 10 years ago, that was the beginning of my engagement in men's work. Having had the background I had, like Andrew, converted to Vajrayana Buddhism, went all the way in with it. I went all in with Zoroastrianism. I converted in the 1990s. We later discovered, especially in these conversations, actually how similar Vajrayana Buddhism and Zoroastrianism are. And we see a path we call the Silk Road, right? So we're still doing the philosophy. We're still doing the theology. But for me personally, the whole journey to spiritual activism started 10 years ago when I realized that political activism was just on the wayside. That was just like, that was just, there was nothing revolutionary about it at all. You know, the revolution today really is a spiritual activism.
Just a couple comments here. It's kind of funny, Max, that you would be surprised that the people would, you know, consider you for spiritual advice when your entire course, the imagery of the course was entirely based on we had all this powerful spiritual imagery in it. So you know, I agree with you that you really held it as a kind of priest, and I'm surprised that you were surprised about that.
Well, it took the participants, but also you and Bard, to say there's something here. You need to continue to pursue it, and I'm with you guys in terms of this idea that if you just sit around and write ideas and turn philosophical and intellectual pirouettes in the sky, that can all be very good. And we all love to do that from time to time. It nourishes the spirit. But we have to be both monks and missionaries to some degree in equal measure, especially in this time. And, you know,
I'm wondering about the line between philosophy, let's say, and being a, you know, as you're using this, the priest archetype, if they're the same thing, because, you know, in Buddhism, there's tons of philosophy. I was having this argument with Tom on the podcast, and he was saying philosophy is philosophy and religion is religion. And the two are completely different realms. And so, I
disagree with that statement. So I'm with you, Andrew, against Tom in that case. The name of Zoroastrianism is Mazdayana. It literally means philosophy. The Persians invented philosophy 1,200 years before the Greeks even knew what the word meant. It was a concept completely imported by the Greeks. It was also imported by the Chinese and the Indians, who later developed their own versions of it. I would even argue that historically speaking, the move from religion to philosophy happens already when we move from polytheism to monotheism. And polytheism and monotheism do not follow each other historically. They're co-developed. Monotheism, though, is the birth of philosophy. Because if you think about it properly, if you think like there are tons of gods out there because there are tons of different archetypes, and men and women have different gods that they worship or whatever, and there are different forces of nature that we try to tame. And when we go hunting, we try to become the animal we're hunting and all that. You think about religion, it's been like this huge amount of different human practices and beliefs and whatever and rituals and all that. And basically human life and social life has been organized. The word literally means what connects people. It's nothing to do with gods or anything. It's what connects people is religion. So if you see that historically, then of course, if I become a philosopher, I would probably disqualify anything supernatural to begin with because I have no evidence that anything supernatural exists. I will get rid of things like blood sacrifice because blood sacrifice is the obvious waste in human society, wasting it on absolutely nothingness. It's just like, I always argue also that building pyramids is another form of massive waste historically. So the idea must have been, okay, let's simplify everything. And the way you simplify polytheism is moving it down to just one coordinate, the absolute. And that's it. And that's still what religion is, even for a philosopher. So I would argue that monotheism is religion as philosophy, whereas religion without the philosophy, just a bunch of practices. You can practice whatever you want. You can worship any idol you like. You can have your own archetype that you want to follow. Here's your role model. Here's a saint for you, etc. All of that popular religion out there was always polytheistic, or we call it iconological. So I think that's a good starting point to discuss where religion and philosophy relate to one another. And of course, then, this is why I hate academic philosophy and why I hate academic theology as they developed, because I hate it when you sit in the armchair and just theorize. It becomes an empty navel-gazing game. It has no value for anybody out there. It's basically wasted time. It as least as wasted as a blood sacrifice would be.
Our friend, our mutual friend, Michael Gibson, just this morning had a tweet to the effect that that we need a return to the kind of philosophy that seeks, and he listed a few things that he wanted to see, a return to the apprehension of truth and the use of reason and the practice of virtue and things that you would have heard in certainly in classical philosophy, particularly pre-Socratic philosophy, answering throughout the classical period and indeed into the Hellenistic period. But the idea that we would ask, how are we to live, has been so depleted and rejected and outright ignored in academic philosophy. It's a joke, but
academic philosophy is dead.
Yeah,
I'm an academic doing economics and political science. That makes perfect sense. And I'm doing it in relationship to digital technology. That's what I do as an academic. I would never do philosophy or theology inside an academic institution. I think those would be dead for the last 100 years.
They're
irrelevant.
Yeah, they're irrelevant, yeah. And this era that we're entering, this that we've been in for a while, is we are now seeing the rise of these rogue intellectuals who are amassing the what you call attentionalist power. Now, it's not to say that all of them are good philosophers, but they're offering something. And there is a migration from the cloister, from the guild, the cartelization of knowledge that higher education has brought about, and it needs to be destroyed. I think we both agree about that. And the way you destroy it is a refocus from the guild or the institution and all of the incentives that prop it up to individuals in networks communicating and garnering attention online. This is powerful stuff. And we need to feed that beast, frankly, in various ways, not merely
so
not
yeah,
it's our time, but we need some we need to get people starting to think of it in that light, like support your favorite philosopher financially, even, you know, subscribe to their thing at $5 a month, whatever, because that is going to help pull them out of that subsidized cloister, that corporate statist cartel, and its useless fucking journal articles, you know, that nobody reads.
Yeah, so the whole interface between human beings and technology, which we're dealing with here all the time, has to be answered philosophically. So you got Michael Gibson, you got Peter Lindbergh, the Stoa, you got a lot of guys out there going for Stoic values or whatever they're doing, trying to find some kind of values and see if they could then fit them into digital age. We can see right away how they have to move into spirituality. And this is the Eastern approach. There's no philosophy without spirituality because the philosophy would be absolutely useless. The whole idea of academic philosophy in the West was simply that philosophers were left to themselves and theologians were taking care of the church. Like, philosophers were banned from spirituality in the West, which is exactly why it became so poor. What it did develop was method, like Hegel, brilliantly. And then it developed a civilizational critique, which is essentially spiritual practice, starting with Nietzsche, for example. So that's what it did. The rest was just like underpinning academic work, meaning the rest was philosophy or science. And that was done well, but very, very limited in terms of the scope that philosophy can have. So we're back at the point now where we import from the East to add to the mix of technology from the West is this idea that Eastern spirituality is absolutely necessary. And it's coming in different waves. There's a massive wave going on, which is called women and female spirituality. We have what, Andrew, 600 different Buddhist monasteries and temples now in Europe and North America? It's like 600 or 700.
France has more than any country in the world, by the way.
Exactly. Women have already switched religion.
Mm-hmm.
They've already moved on to the Buddha statues and statuettes and the candlelights and the meditation techniques and the yoga centers and the retreat centers. When I'm doing men's work, I'm reminding all the men I work with here in Europe that women have already switched religion. They've already completely embraced Easter
And the
spirituality.
men kind of follow. It's interesting.
Well, no, well, the men haven't even started, Andrew, yet. They haven't even started. I mean,
No, but I remember.
if you and I go to something as spectacularly phallic as the Camera Kogge in Bavaria, there's just women everywhere and a few men like us who
Well, that's
love
what
to
La
go.
Mole said, actually. He said that first the women come and then the men, are pulled in. So that's how they, that's how he kind of, that's how La Mole kind of ran his organization
Which
by
is
bringing in
exactly the
women
opposite.
first and then the
But
men
this
come
is
after.
exactly the opposite of activism usually operates. Usually it's the men who go first, the women who follow. Political activism, always the men first. When I start things, organizations, the men join first and the women come in later because the women give it some time to think it through properly before they engage. And when women engage, they engage fully and go 100%. The funny thing here is that the switch to the new religion, which is the imported Eastern spirituality in its Western form, has taken place by women doing it considerately. They've considered, and they've done it over the last 40 years, and the men are totally left behind. And the crisis we have with masculinity in the West is definitely deep spiritual crisis. And here is where my strong argument comes in. When then guys like Jordan Peterson and Richard Dawkins come onto the scene and call themselves cultural Christians and all kinds of other cynical nihilist rubbish, that will not fly. I'm aggressive here. That will not fly. There are proper neo-Christians who actually do believe in Christ and the resurrection, whatever. I can respect those. I work with Paul Robeson, as you all know. But these cynical nihilists, like Dawkins right now and Jordan Peterson before him, totally disapprove of that. There is no spirituality at all in any of that. I see Jordan Peterson just doing a very narcissistic TV show these days. I don't see
Actually, I
any
was just talking
spirituality in
to John Vervaeke about that. He said he went to the conference with Jordan Peterson, and he was strongly critical of what he called cultural Christianity. So, and
Which is
he's
just
also
like
promoting
anti Islam,
the Silk Road and as a corridor between all the different little schools of religion, which seems to be the most creative and sane mode of doing religion,
I'm really
from what
glad
I
John
can see.
Favreau, John Favreau has jumped on our train, finally skipped this religion without, which is not a religion. When we've been advocating a religion, which is finally a religion, which is of course the way to go. What's wrong with religion? And so John Favreau has completely turned around in that case and discovered that his own obsession with Neoplatonism and Zen Buddhism have connections. Maybe we'll then explore Persian, Indian, Chinese traditions in between. I'm really looking forward to what Favreau is going to do next because Favreau has obviously realized that what Peterson did is just the wrong way to go about it. I think we need to switch religion for men too. So this is one thing. The women are coming into the room and they're affecting us. The other thing is, of course, that we're drenched in technology. The technological revolution is in full swing. And this is where the Grey Ops comes in to me, Max. That's why I supported it from day one. I thought it was a fantastic project and I support it any way I possibly can as we go forward because this technological revolution does not have its spiritual companion. It must have one. It must have one. It starts with existential risk to deal with that, you know. But existential risk is, of course, already there. You've got a spiritual issue.
Yeah, and
Existential.
this is the thing that I think this is a point where you and I diverge a little bit. We are at loggerheads a little bit, but it's always been a healthy antagonism. Let me just see if I present your, I want to steel man your position on this because I think this is really important to unpack. So the way I've understood your position is that there are sort of deep archetypes and that in some sense there needs to be a firewall between them or a separation, right? Rather like the separation of church and state, it's the separation of priesthood and builderhood or power. It is the two-headed phallus, right?
We could call it just priest and chief to make it
Priest
easier.
and chief, right? And so when the priest class does its thing, there eventually comes a time when there needs to be an interface point, but these are kind of a mutual check on each other. You don't do my thing, I don't do yours. And when they try to do each other's thing, things turn to shit. And I acknowledge that historically is very much a good thing. And so the way I perceive that is that we needn't take it too far, right? So there needs to be an interface point between the core of the priesthood and relationships with the builders, the techies, and so on at some point. And what I've heard you say is we don't have the timing right. I worry that we don't ever know, we're never going to know when the timing is right. There's a sense of urgency around this. Let's just start experimenting, see what happens. And if the experiments fail, then you would have been proven right. But otherwise, we wouldn't have lost time. That sense of urgency for me is born out of this, the rise of what I call, you know, on the course, the enemy. A lot of people took objection to that because they're like, they're human beings. They're not our enemy. It's like, well, you know, after a certain point, if someone wants to manipulate, control, and subordinate you, they become your enemy. You know, it's like, yeah. Let's call spades spades. You know, don't be pussies. Sorry. Or flaccid dicks is even better. But that's still, you know, an open question. My point, though, is that creates a sense of urgency. There is an elite class that marries corporation and state that is busily planning for us to be timid herds. And we've got to do something about it. And when the builders set about to build and they don't have any kind of spiritual, moral reference point, or it's too vague, they drift off into bullshit like NFTs or what have you. So my aspiration is that the gray robes can provide this interface point and still maintain and be a sutric to a very great degree, but still have a tantric core, if you like, or perhaps better said, a set of esoteric practices. And the set of esoteric practices draw from the kind of traditions and thinkers that you and I are interested in. And they manage to slowly form this core. But the priesthood is responsible for that journey, that exploration of wonder. And then we take a lot of that and provide it to the laity or to the builders and the techies and so on as spiritual nourishment.
And it's like the king has to go to church on a Sunday. And if the king doesn't want to go to church on a Sunday, the priest calls the queen. And this is what I mean when I came to Prospera, for example, in Honduras. You know, this, you can just remind people that this is Hong Kong, Singapore, Dubai model being built in Central America by libertarians and on an island outside Honduras. It's an amazing place. But when you see all the apartments they're building there now, and basically they're putting up a tax haven with gene therapy clinics, that's what they're doing. It's all very technological. All I'm thinking when I walk in there is that, yeah, but the wives will want their yoga studios and the wives will want their tantra retreats and things. And nobody's thought of that on the island. You still go to Tulum, Mexico to do that. So that's why I told everybody, you need me in 5 years' time when your wives will come and say, I don't want to live here. I don't want to live. I hate the Turks and Caicos Islands because it's too boring. You know, why are you creating the Turks and Caicos Islands when I want fucking Tulum? You know, so I can see already that very often the wife historically, or the queen, is the key to spirituality in the royal family. So there's so many ways we'll go about this eventually, because I'm absolutely with you, Max, in this, that we're working very hard on nailing this right. We're working very hard on getting the philosophy right, which is basically the dogma which should then base a proper religion, which you can believe in, which is my point with Christianity. I cannot believe in it. That's why it's dead to me. So the question is then how we go about this. And I give you a perfect example. I love to have concrete examples in the near future, which I can talk about a podcast and the people can see what I actually did afterwards, because I actually need the input from both of you for this one. Next week, I'm giving a speech at the biggest tech conference in Sweden. And I've been asked to give, you know, look into the future for the next 20, 25 years, something like that. It's a standard request. It's also a very difficult thing to talk about, because the first thing you have to tell people you talk about the future is that the future is not going to be anything Do you think it will be? And it's not going to be more of the same. And you're not even going to have the same values 20 years from now. You're going to be so different 20 years from now that you laugh at any assumption that there'll be more of the same. You know, like the old idea that in the future we would drive a certain type of car or fly in a certain way, whatever. Who cares? Who cares? The biggest thing that happened in the last 30 years was a smartphone. And nobody could have predicted 30 years ago that smartphone would be the center of the universe the way it is today. Nobody could have predicted that. It was just a communication tool. So nobody thought anything of it. So this is the first thing you have to tell people when you talk about the future as a futurologist. But besides that, here's the trick. My proposal here is that maybe the best thing I could do at this stage is to not say a single word about technology at all, because this is an obvious technological request, the speech itself, the theme, but to only talk about human spirituality and go straight to spirituality and talk about nothing else in that speech.
That makes
Wouldn't
sense to me because
this rhyme with what we're all three of us doing right now with the gray robes and what Andrew and I are doing, you know, and with Easter spirituality? Wouldn't that rhyme with it?
it makes sense to me because instead of going to spirituality first, people are trying to have this conversation between machine and spirituality, and it doesn't it's often a stilted conversation. Well, you know, I tend to think you need to go to the origins, you know, of spirituality first, and then you can understand technology. Like you can understand the physics of things, but you can't understand the metaphysics of things unless you study philosophy and religion, right?
Well, there's even more to it. The thing is that the machine is now AI, AI driven, obviously. And AI will be very good at a lot of things and be terrible at other things. And the things AI will be terrible with are the things being left to humans to deal with. And if there's anything the AI will not understand, it's the human soul.
Right. So the
It's the
human soul
last, it's the
becomes
last, it,
like.
AI can imitate the products of human soul, but it cannot be human soul. I write music again. I'm back in the studio because I've heard so much shit coming out of AI-produced music, which is nothing but elevator music, nothing else ever, because it's just so bland. It's just so bland and so boring. It's like if you ask the AI to write a Beatles song, it can sound like John and Paul and George singing and all that, and Ringo playing lousily with his drums, but it sounds like a Beatles song written in a retirement home by three demented men. Yeah, all the AI is like that. So it's obvious that AI will not produce anything creative or original. You cannot define AI as even remotely biologically intelligent. It's nothing but a technological intelligence, zeros and ones, processed very, very fast, and that's it. So, I mean, over the next 20 years, that's not going to change that much. We're going to have more and more of the AI. And if you fill up anything that's standardized, anything standard will be AI, backgrounds will be AI. You know, our conversation here will certainly be AI enhanced 6 months from now and look better and sound better. But the content of this conversation will be what we produce here today and nothing else.
Yeah, I this is the this is something that I can feel the tomatoes coming from the audience and maybe even from you guys. But there's a sense for me that especially Andrew, forgive me in advance, but there is a sense for me in which when you suddenly feel called to spirituality, and it is also a useful pragmatic vector for a specific telos. In other words, you have a set of objectives, an agenda, and that agenda is working with, at odds with, against, or at odds with the powerful who are out there, and their machinations are coming, coming, coming. They are sinoforming the world. Shit is happening rapidly. We are about to be introduced to central bank digital currencies. That will be a matrix that we cannot escape easily. We are being treated to massive surveillance, the likes of which we have never seen. All of the things in these dystopian books, spirituality. The idea that you would harness something so beautiful, so precious, so sui generis as spirituality for some end, even if it's counterpower, right? Or counter politics, or anti-authoritarianism. I almost feel guilty about that, but I know at some level that's what I'm doing, that it has to be done. If there's not a spiritual dimension to this kind of anti-authoritarian movement, if it will not be conscious of itself, it will not feel, it will remain bloodless, and all of these geeks will stand by and clap while, oh, quadratic voting is awesome and it was just created on the Ethereum blockchain. Yes, that's great, but that kind of bloodless thinking, while very pragmatic and will have certain applications, is nothing compared to being impelled or inspired to either say no when they invite you to Davos, or yes, go to Davos and try to subvert the shit out of it.
That's good, Max. Yeah, because I think that... you know, I was thinking about your word agenda, and then I thought, what is my agenda, you know, as a Vajrayana Buddhist? And I would say, I'd give you like the traditional answer. The agenda is the liberation of others and yourself, right? It's a purely spiritual agenda in whatever the fuck the form happens to be. It's at the basis of things, so it's more powerful, and then it moves into certain kinds of activism, of course. But I would start there.
But isn't this exactly? I mean, you and I talked a lot about this, Andrew. The great thing about the Silk Road Triad is that they're decentralized from the very beginning. Uh-huh. There is no Rome. There's no Jerusalem. There's no Mecca. So yeah. We're talking about here. We start putting spiritual lingo into the whole thing, and then talk about Western culture. What Max here, fantastically, you just delivered the speech for me that I'm going to have next week, basically.
It was a good speech. Yeah.
If I'm giving that space to give that speech for 2040, I'm going to paint that the surveillance police state is around the corner. We must stop it. Yeah. It's worse than anything else you could think of. Yeah, Forget about anything else. This is the real existential threat. It's not an existential. It just kills all life, period. You'll be lifeless zombies if this happens, basically. And we know communist China already, that everybody tries to escape if they possibly can. It's already going in that direction, and we don't want it. And that's the most likely thing to happen before 24. It's the most likely thing to happen. So it's the Reformation again. It's the Reformation. The last time the Reformation was against the Pope in Rome, okay? This time around, the Reformation is against the political centers of Brussels, Washington, D.C., Beijing, etc., and how they tried to create the surveillance police state, often collaborating with big tech, because big tech has an interest in marrying into these elites. So if the big tech elite, being secularized and hedonistic and, you know, commercialized completely, whatever, consumerist, if they marry into that old elite and these two get intertwined, we're done. We're done. And this is, of course, exactly what a spiritual activism is all about. This, it can't be more spiritual than that. Decentralization itself is the very fundament for me to think freely and to believe freely and to choose freely whatever practice I want to have when I'm religious. And this is why I think this both rhymes in with Eastern spirituality, because it would be laughable to have a center in Buddhism or Taoism or Zoroastrianism. It would be laughable. It's a ridiculous idea to have a Rome or a Jerusalem. There is no center to the world because centralization itself is wrong.
Mm-hmm. But Buddhists had warrior monks that trained and trained and trained, and they could kill you in an instant, and yet they radiate peace when you meet them. Mm-hmm. So they always knew that there was some, you know, samurai elite, like, for example, in Japanese, that the, you know, the Sosei or the Sole? I can't remember. Anyway, the Japanese warrior monks who were Buddhists were constantly under threat from the feudal Japanese powers of the times.
Yeah, it's a soldier monk. A soldier monk is a variety of the soldier, like one in 10 soldiers has the soldier monk archetype. And the soldier monks defend the priesthood and they defend the monastery. So, of course, during the Dark Ages in Europe, we also had soldier monks as well. They were the crusaders, essentially. And then they were swept away eventually by the new royal powers of Europe, etc., because they were a parallel power to the power that already existed. But they stayed in Islam. They're called jihadists. So, the soldier monk character is there to defend the library, and to defend their knowledge and ignore women and children when we're being attacked by the enemy, because the other 9 soldiers out of 10 will defend the women and children. The 10th one is the one who defends the knowledge, because if you think about it, you can kill all the women and children, but you have actually burned the library, the culture, that's proper genocide, because then all memory is gone and the culture is done and over. Yeah. This is why this despair child, there's the logos, which is what the priests represent, the logos, the knowledge, the history, everything being stored. We know our history. We know who we are. We know where we come from. This is why the logos is so firmly on the priestly side. And of course, these tech wizards out there today making all the technologies have no sense of history whatsoever. None.
Well, and
which
they
is
don't
why
have
dangerous.
Any, and they're almost completely devoid of pathos as well. And that can be brought and to them, and all of a sudden, it's like you just this is what I think about analytic philosophy. I mean, I come from that background, and there's certain things about it I love. I mean, it's logos on steroids in many respects. But you know, you go back, and this is what I can say about continental philosophy that I really love, particularly Nietzsche, the Nietzschean turn. You know, Nietzsche understood, it's like, you've got to feel this. You've got to fight for it. You have got to find your power, because it your efficacy, your mastery. Because if you don't, this wave of the elites that's coming at us, I mean, they're going to show you very fast that you don't have a choice but to engage in this. You need to be prepared to love your fate, amor fati, right? Because they are coming, and you need to gird your loins. And part of doing that is bodily, but it is also mental and spiritual.
I love this. You're actually presenting a concept here, ersatz pathos, effect pathos, which is, of course, the technological world is drenched in today. One ersatz pathos is that money does the job for you, because money flows exactly like a phallic force. So to make tons of money, billions of dollars, and get respect out of having tons of money, and then driving your Tesla, whatever, and having all the status symbols and all that, and having the great-looking wife, and most of the tech wizards have terrible marriages and divorce. Every one of them divorces, and none of them ever has children either. It's just terrible, right? So they're not leaving much of a mark, are they? But then also, by putting a lot of oomph into the technology itself, which is basically putting the electricity into it and putting the oomph into the technology, and then spinning it around the world, is also ersatz pathos. That's not pathos at all. You're absolutely right. Pathos is totally bodily. It's you. It's in your own body. And of course, they completely missed out on that. They often look miserable too. They have bad physical health. You know, they have their gym instructors with them wherever they go. And I'm certainly they're under a tyranny when it comes to diet and all that, try to look as well as possible because they're going to be media stars or whatever. But I mean, they're not doing the spiritual work. They're not doing the personal spiritual work.
They're not doing real spiritual work. They're doing
exactly,
this kind of
exactly.
pseudo, you know, Californian spiritual work, which is.
What's the fellow's name who's the guy who's basically wears t-shirts that says don't die, and he's got all of his cells dialed back to the status of a 20-year-old? Brian Johnson?
Brian Johnson, I think, yeah.
I mean, interesting guy. And he's super healthy, and he seems to have a level of calm and relative centeredness. And this is the other thing, is that we have to be able to be in practice self-possession, which I think spirituality can do too, but it's still looking at spirituality.
But this guy has done
way.
This guy has done nothing but training himself to be self-objectifying, which is the opposite of being spiritual. I met him, we had a conference, together. I highly respect that. But he's a total tech nerd, and he cannot teach a single man about spirituality.
And it's just
the vitamins and the proteins and whatever, and it's all the nutrition, and it's biohacking and all that. That's just another form of. It's just that we know men are being self-objectified.
That's called, like, Trump called that spiritual materialism, which is rampant, right?
Yes, exactly. It's so superficial. It's incredibly superficial. It won't teach you anything.
It's a loop. When you ask him about anything in a deep way, it's very circular. It's like, because it's like, no, I mean, like, you're an interesting and smart guy, but you came from Mormonism. You abandoned your Mormonism because you were probably a little bit autistic and very talented. excuse my, neuroatypical, whatever it is called,
And
neurodivergent.
now we call it techno-Mormonism because that's probably where he's developing. So.
Yeah. It's like, but like, it's again, it's like it, there's nothing there. It's like when you strip away the bits and bytes, you have a longer life for what?
Exactly. It's like you ask them, say, oh, you get the longevity, what are you going to do with it? And they don't have the answer.
Yes, we're going to solve all the world problem with science. We're going to do
Listen,
have more scientists who live longer and think longer and
your
are
problem is that
healthier.
your problem is you don't even have a family. You don't even raise kids. You don't understand we've got a demographic crisis coming because
Well,
of
he
guys
did.
like
He
you.
took his kid's blood and infused it in himself and his dad, and he reversed his dad's aging with his kid's blood plasma. It's like it's interesting stuff, but it's like I asked the question in the course, and I don't know if you guys remember this, but it's like, for what are you willing to die, and for what are you willing to live? And if you can't answer that question without a circuitous, sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of whatever it is you're doing technologically, then you haven't answered the question. The answer is spiritual. The answer is spiritual. It is philosophical.
Totally agree.
Course it is. Yeah, I mean, what,
I knew I would give you guys would give me food for thought for the speech next week. I'm certainly going to be very serious about this. And you're absolutely right, Max. The real question today is how do we avoid building a surveillance police state? And can we even escape it? How do we fight centralization? Because all the efforts right now is to use AI towards centralization, and the excuses are out there. Whenever I hear the word child pornography, I know I'm dealing with a politician who wants nothing else but a police state. And they use the lamest, worst possible excuses they could possibly come up with.
Oh, it's
Always.
always, yeah, it's always that stuff. It's with Bitcoin. There are money launderers out there. We gotta, right. You are filleting a jackboot. I know what you're doing behind that curtain.
That's so true. That's so true. So, spirituality digitalates. Let's go back here. Women
I
are ahead. Women are ahead of men already, right? Women are ahead of men already, and they're converting massively to Eastern spirituality, and men need to catch up. So, this is why I propose the part of the mix we're talking about is a phallic spirituality for men, based on the Eastern traditions, because they're totally superior to Western traditions, at least. As far as I'm concerned, because Christianity and Islam, they were very efficient machines to run feudal societies once upon a time. But I can't seriously believe in a religion that says that whatever I do with my life, I'm going to go somewhere else, which is better and get an afterlife, because it was just the biggest lie ever. And without that lie, sorry, Christianity, Islam, there's nothing left. So that's just the end of it. So I propose the Silk Road tried is one way to go. Then we also wrote the Synthesis book. We have the possibility of just restarting the whole thing and reinvent spirituality because we are living in a new age called digital. And that's why I think the Grey Robes is a great name for that. It's like one of the first really proper synthesis products. The other ones have been art products, but this is one that takes the whole thing seriously. What if we just need to reinvent spirituality and religious practice for the digital age? For us to
Well,
make
to
meaning,
talk
to get out
about
of the consumerist loop, shit
well,
like
what
that.
but what about Zufism? I mean, that's we're you know, Zufism is that's compelling,
Yeah, the idea is that we take a Z instead of an S at the beginning, call it Zuvisms because it's Zufi. And it can be interpreted, for Varki, it probably interpreted instantly as Zen meets Sufism, which he would love because then it's Zen meets Nato Platonism. But actually, the proper etymological word, Zuvism, it's neutral in Arabic. You can spell it with a Z or an S. The Sufism is older than Sufism. Zufism is the oldest pre-Islamic form, which originates in the Sirvanite cult in Persia, in the Sassanid Empire, prior to Islam. And the Sirvanite cult was a religion that was never to be written down. It was passed on from one priest to the next, or from one monk to the next, if you like to have that terminology. And because it was never written down, it was completely, totally esoteric. It was only meant to stay inside the temple, what we call adytonology. It was an adytonological practice, right? And this, of course, very similar to Vajrayana, very similar to Zen. You find it everywhere in Eastern spirituality. These traditions that you isolate the monks somewhere because they're basically living in a human laboratory. And you don't know what's going to come out of that monastery. So you better keep a wall around it and then check what's coming out of the monastery so it isn't absolute madness. And you know, the Zurbanites, they went after the Manichaeans when the Manichaeans came along. They went after them aggressively in the 3rd century, led by Carter, the ultimate Zurbanite. And Carter was convinced, he was very public about this in Sassanid Empire in the 3rd century, that the Gnostics are going to be the curse of humanity. And they're going to preach dualism. They're going to preach that everything physical is bad, your body's bad, and you are bad, everything. But you have a soul inside of you, which is clean and pure. And that soul can put you above everybody else, all other humans, and you can come and go to the heavens and live in some other world. It's the total, ultimate lying sect, a sect that is a total lie. And this is the dualism they fought. And of course, it survived in different forms and was tamed and domesticated and became Christianity and Islam later, which is exactly what the Zurbanites warned us about. So I'm going back to that. I think Sufism for me is the practice. I'm going to practice aggressively. I'm a Zoroastrian and I love Buddhism. So I can take Eastern spirituality, modernize it, and Sufism is that name. Exactly.
I know that
That's going to be fun.
Irina Tweedy introduced a lineage of Sufism, like with an S, into the West and claimed it was pre-Islamic. That these were Sufis who just they were called the blanket wearers, and they came along and they hung out with Muhammad for a while, as soon as Muhammad died, they were persecuted. They weren't actually part of the Muhammad tradition, and they called Sufis. Is that the same thing as
Yeah, I
the
mean,
Sufis, or is it something else?
if you speak Persian or Arabic, the term is calendaria, which is where the word calendar comes from, because these were Sufis who only followed time. Time was their only god. Can you see Zurban? You
Yeah,
know,
Zurban is the god of
among the
ending
priests,
time.
the only religion that exists is time itself.
Yeah.
And we teach people how to love each other by talking to God on their behalf. But time is the only god we really submit to. If there's just going to be one god, it's going to be time. That's Zurbanism. And that's inherited by the Kalandaria Sufis. And of course, if you go to the Muslim world today and you talk to a Shia Muslim cleric in Iran, he will hate the Kalandaria Sufis more than anything else in the world. They're the ultimate heretics, according to him. And the interesting thing among the Zurbanites, the Muslims eventually become the ultimate heretics because they came out of Mazdak in the 6th century. Mazdak, 100 years later, was Muhammad. Mazdak was the Persian Muhammad before Muhammad, who was the Arabic Mazdak, came along 100 years later, that became Islam. But here's the thing, the Sufism was then disguised under Islam, but always in conflict with is Muslim scholarship because Sufism is fundamentally non-dogmatic. And Islam and Christianity
They're
can't stand,
non-dualist.
they can't stand the non-dogmatic. Islam and Christianity are just different dogmas fighting each other, and theology is everything. And fighting it out between these nerds is what Islam and Christianity has been doing for the last 2,000 years. So the origin of the Sufis as pre-Islamic is definitely Zoroastrianism and Buddhism. Buddhism also heavily influenced Sufism because Buddhism was widespread in Central Asia at the time when Sufism started developing. So if you go from about 500 before Christ until 500 after Christ, right before Muhammad comes along, during that period, Buddhism dominates Central Asia. Absolutely. It has enormous influence. So this is why the similarities, for example, between Zen in Japan, Shan in China, and Zoroastrianism and Zurbanite practice in Persia, and of course the Buddhist practice coming out of India are so similar. They're so similar. So that's one project. And I think,
So how does that
Max,
jive with the gray robes? How
I
does
think the gray robes is fundamentally the sutric aspect of it. Although I agree with Max, the gray robes should certainly have both a sutric practice and a tantric practice as a priesthood should do. But maybe then Sufism is really for the mystics, scoff and do their thing, whatever. I don't really know how that would play out, but I think Max is going one direction with his next book, and I'm probably going another direction in my next book. But they're definitely books we're going to write in parallel or develop in parallel, for example, in these conversations, because Sufism as an idea of taking Eastern spirituality into a modern, basically phallic mysticism, is exactly the same idea as the gray robes. It's just the esoteric version of the gray robes.
So I'm gonna show you a lot of ignorance here with this question, but particularly going back to this question of women embracing Eastern religion and Eastern practices. I don't get a sense, and you showed a lot of admiration for it. You said that the women are ahead of the men and the men are following. Is this a European phenomenon? Because in the United States, my sense is, and God, I hate to put this out here on the internet, but my sense is that the kind of Eastern spirituality and practices that women are embracing here are woo-woo, fluff, consciousness community, recitation of a few terms that they learned in yoga class, and it's about an inch deep.
Listen,
Yeah, but there's.
female spirituality is exactly like that. It's what Nietzsche called, it is intense in the superficial. Female spirituality really is like that. And that's where its depth lies. It's just that I'm working now with women here in Scandinavia, the most amazing women, Lovisa Alsén, Åsa Jonsson, Farah Norlin. They're doing terrific women's work. And we're going to start doing projects together this fall. We're going to do futurology as men's work and women's work as futurology, which is tons of fun. But there's so, when I talk to them, they're just like, yeah, the archetypology you guys talk about makes sense for you men because it's horizontal. Because you describe different archetypes. You start with the priest, the chief, and then next level, you go to the soldier and the hunter, and then you get four patriarchs out of that. That starts to make sense. And it folds all the way down into any sort of male profession, any sort of career a man tries to make. So a man can become a protector and a provider, and therefore deserve to have sex with a woman. Makes sense. And they've asked me about female archetypology until they, of course, started developing the female type archetypology themselves. They have discovered that the female archetypology is vertical. It's really the same woman. And this is why I told you that if you want to get access to the king, when the king doesn't understand, needs to go to church on Sunday, you talk to the queen.
There's the queen.
You talk, because you could talk to any woman who's married to a man, and she will be spiritual in precise in this sense. So from our perspective, looking from a phallic spirituality, we start, with our dick between our legs and our dick in our head and our pathos and our logos, and we men and we think about male spirituality. When we start looking at it, when we start looking at female spirituality, it looks absolutely flat from our viewpoint. But when women look at spirituality from their perspective, they think our spirituality is very simplistic and absolutely superficial, and they see no depth in it at all. So the problem is, yes, of course, there's always charlatans out there, and I'm not a big fan of New Age, but I know a lot of women who came in through New Age and started taking Buddhist practice seriously. And hey, the time they spend on their yoga, meditation, taking care of themselves, being good mothers, being good women, talking to me now how desperate they are to actually have more children, and they know where are the men, they're doing the deep female spiritual journey for sure. But remember, when we look at female spirituality from our perspective, it looks absolutely flat.
Well, I also want to
Yeah.
comment on what you said about American Buddhism, because I have a lot of experience in those circles. I think
Not
that,
Buddhism. I don't. I was just talking
well,
about
just
more
yeah,
New
well,
Agey consciousness community.
the whole well, it's in all of those Eastern traditions. There's something about America that turns everything into a product and kills it. So often the original inspiration is great. There were some amazing women practitioners in Vajrayana who completely powerful beings. And the word for that is Dakini. And the Dakinis, they're not necessarily soft and spiritual, and they're fierce and ferocious and dangerous, and they can be motherly. They can also be wild. They can be all kinds of things. So I think that there's a richer palette in the Eastern traditions of feminine wisdom than there is in Christianity and Islam, which tends to see either the virgin or the whore, and that's all there is, and the mother.
Totally. You're so right. You're so right,
Yeah.
Andrew. This makes perfect sense. Vishnu and Shiva are separated because men need them separated, but actually Shakti and Kali just switch. It's the same character. Just two different faces of the same character. So the woman changes the persona, the mask, and it's the same woman behind it. I think these women are working with her onto something amazing. We had the conversation at the Utah conference recently, and I told Fanny, you're so fucking bright. You're a fantastic female philosopher. Work on the vertical, the idea of the vertical female archetypology. You do amazing work. You'll have an entire career just based on that. But I think this makes sense. I think this perspective makes sense. Just like women are just mythos all the time. Women are mythos all the time. That means, for example, I'm glad you mentioned the Madonna whore dichotomy because it's a total male fantasy. Women are so relieved when I say that. It's because we men are obsessed with the two brain halves. We're obsessed with the logos and the pathos. We're obsessed with that dichotomy. And when we project ourselves onto woman, the way Jung calls the nima, we project ourselves onto woman, we think of her as either a Madonna or a whore because we force ourselves to be the priest or chief. But in reality, every damn woman is both Madonna and whore at the same time. When your best friend is asking who he's going to marry, then ask him for the pictures. He's got 40 women on his cell phone these days, smartphone these days that he's admiring. I said, no, half of them are just whores, according to you, and half of them are Madonnas you don't want to fuck. So, you know, just show to your mother. So get rid of those. When you find that one woman who's neither the Madonna or the whore, two negations, neither Madonna or whore, you show it to a friend and he would go, oh God, not her, not her. I'm so in love with her. She's the best sex I ever had, but she won't have me. And it's like, go for her, brother. That's the wife. And women love when we dissolve that stupid dichotomy Madonna whore because it's strictly a boyish fantasy coming out of the, for us men, necessary division between logos and pathos. So again, their spirituality might look flat. So I wouldn't say that a lot of these Eastern spirituality women in America are in any way superficial when you start actually getting to know them and going into their spirituality. And again, consider the amount of time and energy they spend on it and how it immunizes them against the commercialization and the commoditization of society as a whole. How they get immune against precisely those demons that we're fighting as men as well. And that's ultimately how you judge your religion, how immunized you become against the bad forces of the world.
I guess I also lived in Austin for a while, and there is a real just concentration of facile horseshit there. You know, it's just a lot.
I was in Asheville before I came to visit you in South Carolina, and Asheville is even worse.
Oh, I know.
It's so much.
Remember,
worse.
That's
but
where
we
my
have
family
horseshit. We have horseshit in male spirituality too. Spirituality is just full of horseshit because it's so attractive. It's so attractive, and of course, all the idiots who don't know anything else they could do these days to become a life coach. And here's the irony: How can you become a life coach when your own life is a misery? What are you there to coach?
it's the Enneagram 3 people all end up as life coaches, and
I know like a woman who spent 30 years in a hut. You know, she left her family, and while she was in the hut, she learned to be an artist and became a master at Cuban percussion. And when she went to Cuba, the people were so surprised at how good she was that they almost had a heart attack that a woman was playing Cuban percussion like a master. She just completely went fully into it. I also know another woman who has mastered the yogic practices to the point where, you know, she would just have to, you know, recite a mantra, lean back, and she would go into bliss to the point where she might even pass out. I mean, there's a lot of these people who are quite extraordinary, you know, behind the scenes of the new age bullshit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there are female yogis, there are male yogis, there are people who take these things seriously. As far as I'm concerned, it's also a work I'm doing with Fanny Nolini is to try to check in if the shamanoid character is equally common among men and women. It turns out that the shamanoid character is indeed equally common among men and women. Men and women have the same need for spirituality, but we develop very different spiritualities. And this is why, again, you know, the great thing with religion is that it starts with the separation of men and women. It starts there. Spiritual work always starts with separation because men and women have totally different needs. The one place you really see sexuality come forward and sex come forward and see how different men and women are precisely in spiritual work. And of course, with secularization and saying we don't need spirituality, you know, or it's just a personal choice or some commodified thing over there, which is, of course, it's capitalism ruined spirituality in that sense. When we start looking beyond that, we discover that actually it's precisely in spirituality that men and women come forward as totally different and even alien to each other, which is the whole point with sexual attraction. They're not the same at all.
Right. We're meant to be polarities in a sense, which is one of the reasons why in the kind of framework that you've been developing with respect to the priest and the chief, you know, there's got to be the male and the female as that's just as strong a dynamic, maybe even more fundamental. I remember reading in this sort of Kabbalah text called the Zohar about the Shekinah, which is this manifestation of God that is feminine. And boy, did that is sort of at odds with this notion of patriarchy to some degree, but There is a there's definite about this the dominion of the home, and when you know, or the tent, because often they're nomadic. When the man leaves the tent, you know, there's Shekinah inhabits the tent, and he is still married to Shekinah, God, as he is his wife who's back in the tent. And this interplay and this fusion, this animus anima variation of God, of a Hebrew God, is super interesting, because we always have these very male, you know, burning bush manifestations, and you know, kill your son Isaac, Abraham, you know, this kind of stuff. It's just very masculine, very, because I told you so, motherfucker,
Well, the
kind of
burning
stuff.
bush seems to me like a feminine-ish image.
No, no,
I know
no,
in the
no.
Hebrew,
Wait, wait. No.
that the Shekinah is the world. It's the feminine at the base of the tree, right? It's
Exactly,
actually the
exactly.
world, whereas and the masculine is the yesod, which is the phallic penetration up. But Malchut, you know, is Shekinah, which is the world in Hebrew.
When you fundamentally go into manifesting, you discover that Mother Earth is first. So female category is first, but it is the world. And then the sky god becomes what is not the world, or the opposite of Mother Earth. So that's why men are supposed to worship the phallus, and women are supposed to worship the earth itself, the matrix, you know. And this fundamental to religion, and this is inherited in Christianity. I have to defend it here, because in Christianity, of course, the congregation, the church, is called the bride of Christ. The femininity lies in the congregation itself. And this inherited from Zoroastrianism. So Zoroastrian, the triad, the Shakti Kali triad in Zoroastrian is the congregation, the Anjuman itself, or the Sangha in Buddhism is the feminine. And therefore the masculine is then who leads us. And that's the priest, the chief role. So for example, in the Exodus, Aaron and Moses are walking ahead, and they are the patriarchy, and because that's the priest chief role in Judaism. But of course, they have an older sister. Her name is Miriam, and she's the matriarch, and she's the last person to cross the Red Sea. After her, she goes this way. If you're behind her, you're dead. That means behind her is Kali, in front of her is Shakti, in the sense that the last post out is the matriarch. But women follow and men lead. And this is always the case throughout civilization. This is the case with nomadic life too. Men sacrifice themselves by walking at the front, protecting the women and the children at the very end. And of course, the oldest woman in the tribe walked at the very end of the whole thing when there was a nomadic movement. So if this is nomadology, if this is the original religion, then it makes sense that it's actually equal. It's equal all along. I've never ever heard a Zoroastrian not say that the sexes are equal. They practiced equality in the sexes for 3,700 years. It's just that men lead and women follow. It's the most natural thing in the world. And there's equality to it. Leading is not superior to following. Like in a tango, like in a tango.
Don't
There's a
women
symbolism
men
of.
follow in the interior, and then you know, women follow in the exterior or something like that, because men follow, if you live in a house, you know, the woman is the ruler of the house in many ways, right?
Yeah,
So
the
the
inner
so we,
realm
we
is the matriarchy, and
yeah.
the outer realm is the patriarchy of any social
There's
constellation.
just there's a symbolism of the Red Sea too, as being a birth canal, where it's ejecting this new life, this new entity.
Even to the extent, I would say that the demographic crisis coming in the 2030s. We'll talk a lot about demography in 10 years' time than even about climate change, even if climate change gets more desperate, because the demographics will be the big next issue in politics and spirituality, because we're not giving birth to children. And we're all like pre-programmed to know there's something fundamentally wrong with the society. We're not giving birth to children. This, of course, what the cultural Christians are arguing. If there's anything I would agree with them on this conversation today, the Dawkinses and the Petersons out there, is that when sexuality was secularized, it, of course, turned into hedonism. We got the pill. We got the condom. People started fucking like mad. They could live out any fantasies they like. At least those of us who made enough money and were good looking enough had those fantasies fulfilled, and the rest of us got frustrated. So basically, that was the game of sex that we had. And of course, now we have reactions against that and lots of dialectical problems. But the problem here is that in a completely secularized society that refuses to recognize the value of spirituality, you kill sexuality. You really do. And what happens to sexuality is you turn it into nothing but kick seeking, it becomes addiction.
And there's no Bard absolute. Maybe that's the
There's no barred
thing.
absolute. Exactly.
Yeah.
If there's
Yeah.
no barred up, if there's no barred absolute, if there's no hindrance to your sexuality at all, if you're
Yeah.
supposed to get it any minute. And this is exactly here in Scandinavia. People are obsessed with now criminalizing prostitution because the connection of sex and money is so distorted. But they end up with these really spooky secular ideas that both sex and money are somehow wrong and sinful. And when you put the two sins together, you get the ultimate sin. And this is secular people who go crazy about this because they haven't really figured out what money is. It's a phallic force, it's driving the world. It's like blood. And sexuality is this amazing, powerful force, which is built on the attraction of the opposites. It's like the mystery is what I'm attracted to. And if I'm a man and I'm attracted to a woman because I can't understand her, then that's the exact opposite of what secularization took sexuality, because it took it to the point where I would understand her completely to the point where
She's
she
just
became
like
an.
me. We're just the same,
And we're
you
just the same, but she's
know.
still a pornographic object. So somehow I could totally
Doesn't
go.
work.
The difference was only the objectification. It was the difference between her and me was only objectification. She's supposed to be exactly like me in every other regard. And I'm supposed to be exactly like her in every other regard. There's supposed to be no difference between the two sexes, but I'm still supposed to be attracted to her. What happens? All I can do is to go deep into pornography and then become a tick-seeking addict. That's exactly where, and this is where the Petersons and the Dawkins and the culture Christians agree with us. We secularization, spirituality done out the window, and you think you're going to save your sexuality in that
Well, it's
process?
about
You
ritual,
ruin
isn't
it.
it?
You
It's,
ruin it.
I was talking to Zach, or Zach was talking about ritual, you know, in our courses, and how the fact that, you know, a university lecture is a ritual, and so Zach's teaching a course, you know, now at Parallax, brilliant, just
Highly
like me,
recommended. Fantastic. Zach
and
Stein's out there. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I so I asked him, I said, what kind of ritual is this? You know, so but we don't think in terms of ritual. I think sexuality is ritual. I think, you know, a university lecture is a ritual. You know, he said, yeah, this is a university lecture. There's discussion and there's a Q&A after. That's what kind of ritual it is. And I'm like, yeah, obviously. I mean, that's a perennial kind of a ritual. It's like a religious ritual. So I think the ritualization is something that needs to come back.
Well,
And
it has to be deeper than that because this is the perfect example of the whole tantric sex trend, right? There are two ways of doing this, which I think rhymes really well with Max's critique before about the superficiality, about bad religion or bad spirituality. One of them is that these very commercialized, very secularized, very green relationships where I use you and you use me and we have a sex life together, that kind of superficial sexuality that a totally capitalist society devoid of spirituality has fostered us to. Okay. That sexuality is then like, okay, we can't get the kick out of each other any longer, so we're going to go into and learn tantric sex. And they see that's nothing but a technique to enhance their sex life and keep it going for a few more years before the final split comes anyway. Because they're just extracting the last little energy out of each other they could possibly have. Now, the other trend is again the one that we're interested in that's a serious interest in tantric sex. And the first thing you learn there is that this is a spiritual practice. This is deeply spiritual. You cannot go in and expect to just be taught a technique on how to fuck better. That's ridiculous. This is the opposite of that. This is not about learning the technique. The technique will be there as well because you will actually learn, but you will learn why it's valuable to you because you're actually turning your sex life and your married life into a ritual. This
And
tantric sex, I think, is
you're
the perfect
clarifying your,
example
you know, there's
of the superficial and the deep. And here, women agree with us. Women are more into the real thing than men are. When it comes to real practice tantric sex today, women are way ahead of men again, and they're frustrated not more men can discover it and finally have a sex life where you fuck for 6 hours instead of fucking 6 minutes. The clear case of where we find people who do take spirituality very seriously today, but we also have that superficial, totally fluffy white tantra, whatever bullshit thing out there as well.
Yeah,
They're both
because
there.
it's I don't think it's kind of like it's a practice of, you know, Tantra is the area where you bring in the high octave energies and you learn to use them artfully. So it's not some adolescent fucking game or whatever. It's much more.
It leads to an interesting question. And Max, have you considered bringing tantric sex into the mix of the Grey Robes? Obviously, you
Oh
have.
yeah, I have. I definitely have, yes. And my just as my I have a desire to bring in psychedelics. I recognize that there needs to be an inner sanctum. And I recognize that there needs to be a very because you know the adenton that you described is the inner sanctum.
Yes.
There is an outer sanctum, and that has value too. So, and then there's like the sanctuary. Let's just say, let's not use too much Christian symbolism, but there's a place where a congregants can gather. And then there is maybe a sanctum and an inner sanctum. And each of these has specific function. There was a guy that Tom told me about, Peter Sloterdijk.
Sloterdijk,
Peter
yeah.
Sloterdijk,
yeah,
Yeah.
famous German philosopher, yeah.
Yeah. That he has this theory of spaces,
Spheres, yeah.
yeah.
spheres, yeah. And I really
One
want.
of them is here, right on the table. So I have to struggle with Sloterdijk all the time. A lot of people call him his son. So he works with spheres. He's written three amazing books. This one's called Foams. They're all the series called Spheres. Yeah.
I want to run with if you're not going to do anything with it, Bard, and I always credit you when I can because I love stealing your great ideas.
It's
But
interesting in India that actually the outer, on the outside of the monastery, you have all the sexual images, and inside it's the sanctum. So in other words, the sexuality is a way in. It's not the thing in itself. It's not like sex is going on inside. It's the sex is going on outside,
Well,
or the sex is a portal to the transcendent.
yeah, but
Oh, is that right?
back to Max's visions. I'm
Yeah,
just yeah.
please.
Well,
I just wanted to
I just
throw that
think
in.
that there's a something that all three of us are kind of onto something. We're sort of circling around something. We don't want to come across as moralistic in sort of traditional Abrahamic religious terms, as particularly Christianity. And I also don't want to alienate Christians from participation in the gray robes. I think like the Freemasons, there can be a balance. I could be wrong about that, but they'll self-select out if it's not appropriate. But I want to say this. I really do think there's something when you explore aspects of what, you know, of the Jungian shadow or what has been tabooized or whatever that can in healthy ways, like you're describing, when you do it in ritual fashion, where you establish a sexual practices with your partner that not only enliven the relationship, but probably yield in just very utilitarian terms, deeper satisfaction that transcends just the sexual act and leaks into the relationship that you're trying to preserve for so many good reasons. This sounds like, you know, family values, and I suppose it is, but like that dialectic that we've talked about, that too much shit, too much kink has spilled out into the streets, and it's become productized and commoditized, and everybody's got some kind of kink or some kind of poly thing they're doing, and it's all so popular, and everybody's just, oh, we're so liberated now. But when you remove it from these spheres of the sacred, it becomes completely meaningless. And as you say, you eventually kill it. And that's why we're killing it in this country and in mostly the West, I would say. Europe too.
Because you make it a technique again, outside of the fabric of the ritual.
It's like in
Well,
Sweden, the
yeah.
whole hunt against prostitution going on here, coming from radical feminists, by the way, is the argument is that sex has been commodified. What they don't realize is that all sex now is commodified. Mm-hmm. Irony is that yeah. is commodified per se. You can't even go into the bedroom with a guy, if you're a girl, without buying that specific little underwear you're supposed to have according to the latest kinky trend or whatever. The total objectification of the two sexual partners to each other is the end of the human soul in sexuality. And it's a really empty void. And it can only lead in one direction, and that's sex addiction. And that's what we see massive amounts of everywhere. So in that regard, the rediscovery of sexuality has to go through the tantra. I have this one argument with Christians, of the neo-Christians out there, but if they're interested in tantric sex, and if they're interested in psychedelics, and if they're interested in psychoanalysis, the Freudian or Lacanian version, then I'll talk to them. But my experience with the neo-Christians is that they turn down all those three things because they recognize them as sin. Then I can't have the conversation with them, because if you yeah. can't do what we're doing now and here without having a tantric sphere, which is central to what we practice, then we're done. Because you're absolutely right, Max. The added terminology, if you go to Shavindawantay in Peru and look at these huge temples that are 3,000 years old, Shavin culture is very similar to Persian culture. And you see this, there's the smallest adyton inside the very center, inside the temple, it's for the priesthood only. And then outside, and that's where the lansan is, the holy fellows, by the way. And then you have another adyton outside of that, have a third adyton outside of that, and then have a huge adyton where the people are invited in once a year for the great festivities when everybody's participating, and obviously they had sexual rituals. So the stronger the inner sanctum is, the more outer sanctums we can have and give them strength. But the ultimate strength from the whole adytonology comes from the very center. And this is the center we're interested in. We're interested in the spiritual heart. We're going to fight the social center out there that churches and nation states and empires are trying to construct, these huge capitals of these privileged elites who want to control the rest of us through the surveillance police state.
You're bringing back the center. We start talking about decentralization.
Yeah, but this is the Axis Mundi religion, which is the inner sanctum of the temple. In this sense, there is a center, but it's a center which is spiritual. And it's the exact opposite of the centralization that politicians and the other guys are doing out there, because that center is just surveillance police state. This is a center that doesn't surveillance anybody. It is its own center, and it creates, you know, the rings on the water coming from the center of the religion. That, I think, is a center. It's the Axis Mundi in anthropology.
I mean, you got to give credit where it's due. And I think to a very great extent, you know, the idea of marriage, of public acknowledgement of two people who are meant to have children and raise them together with the extended community around them and support of them. This model works. It is important to sacralize it. And to the extent that you desacralize it, and I mean, I'm as capitalist as they come in terms of just like creating value and making revenue in excess of cost. I have no problem with that. And yet I don't care all that much about money, because money's not everything in life. In fact, it's about, you know, it's about seven down on the list. But, you know, we have got to, without turning into, what is that Canadian woman who has the book with the women wear the red robes because they're breeders or whatever, and it's like this bizarre...
The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, The Handmaid's Tale, yeah. The Handmaid's Tale, I can never remember it. Yeah. The Handmaid's Tale kind of society. If you recreate that in the interest of responding to sexual liberation waves that started in the 60s because of the pill, and you go into that direction, that is also bad. So yeah, but this is the dialectics.
The trick here might be actually in less Christianity, in the sense that this is the funny thing I have to tell you from data anthropology, but in cultures we have a lot of whorehouses, the marriages stay together better.
Yes.
It's actually the eradication of the whorehouse in contemporary radical feminism that actually has increased the divorce rate. And I think it's just worth keeping that in mind, that by treating marriage as a sacred institution, which it should be, We all love our girlfriends and wives, whatever. We have, by the way, you guys have fantastic wives. I must say that in this conversation. I mean, but actually, at least when you go to Eastern spirituality, it's perfectly okay to have the sex outside the marriage, because the whole concept of having sex inside the marriage is something that is a sin. It's absurd, because you can enhance your sex life any way you like, and you hopefully keep it together with your wife for the 30 or 40 years you can share a sex life together. That's just automatic. But you can self-arrange your marriage with somebody and then have sex with other people if you like. For example, gay people can also get married with the opposite sex and have children, which is how they often solve it in those cultures, because they're then allowed to have gay and lesbian sex on the side. So there's so many ways to arrange that. I wouldn't say Christianity is the answer, because Christianity failed when it collided with capitalism, and it is a Christian society today, which has these enormous divorce rates and women refuse to get married. And then in East Asia, for example, Korea and Japan, they get married, but the women refuse to have children because they can't have careers, because they have no mothers who take care of the children, which is usually what happens in most cultures. We need to go back to an archetypology and find out actually what works. And the whole demographic crisis is going to lead to understanding deeper. And it's got to be a very pragmatic solution to it, not a principle.
Well, you're Swedish feminists who are trying to ensure that prostitution is made illegal are a recapitulation in some sense of Christian Puritanism.
Exactly. But we do have daycare centers, which are actually kind of a pagan idea in this culture, and they work. So Sweden and France have higher birth rates than the rest of Europe, because you French, you have the creche, you have the daycare center. So All I'm saying is that when it comes to demography, you have to listen to women and basically ask women, what would make you want to have more children? And the answer is the answer. It's not your fantasized male answer, it's the female answer, which is the only answer you must work from. So I think that's demographics coming up, but it's just one of many spiritual issues we got ahead of us. Listen guys, I could talk to you guys forever, but maybe we should round up this conversation and then have another check-in and how we're doing, and if in a couple of months time or something, what do you say?
Absolutely,
forever and always. I always enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, Max, you're the perfect guest for Sweden versus Sparta, let's put it that way, because this was always a podcast about contemporary spirituality. And with you joining the fold and leading the gray robes, you're our favorite guest.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I am totally honored. Thank you guys so much.
And of course, we hope there's a gray robes too coming up soon at Parallax, but we can talk about that off.
I want to see the gray robes book, because the thing, I read all of Max's books and he writes fantastically. He's just a great, great writer. I would love to have a Grey Rose book. It could be either the thin one, which is like a presentation, or it could be a thick one where he really digs deep into it and Max Borders, the philosopher, comes forward. But the preachy part in you tonight here in the conversation, Max, was awesome. And I take it with me for next week for my speech that I'm going to give next
steal
week.
Steal it Stockholm. Shamelessly. You know I steal your shit all the time.
And I refer to you as well, as you know I do, as you do with me.
Yeah.
So, yes, I will.
I perceived an orator in you tonight as well, Max. I saw the orator come out. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that's delightful. I really enjoyed it. I always love talking to you guys, and I'm ready to make things happen. You know, I think that's what's going on. I don't know if you guys are making stuff happen in your own way, and I have felt very cloistered, to beat that metaphor to death. So I've got to come out. Of the monastery.
I think it's going to happen even in a big way, for the simple reason that I know all the tech guys are terrified of AI themselves. Why? Because AI will also reveal their weaknesses and their lack of spirituality. And that's what people are going to demand from them. I'm working on it right now, where spirituality is going to end up, and it's collision with capitalism, and it's going to be front row in the tech world eventually. And we're just basically our building, providing for them to find the spiritual path with us as contemporaries. That's what we're doing. Great,
guys. All right, gentlemen.
Big love to your beautiful wives.